The theater, the theater. Bring out Louis!
Theater, theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater, theater.
Hey,
how's things?
Well, I started telling this right beforehand, but I had to watch a clip of the Bob Dylan musical, and it was The Times They Are a-Changin', and or like a Rolling Stone. I can't remember the number that they did was like a Rolling Stone, and it's like. You can criticize Dylan's voice all you want, but it relayed the truth of the song and the meaning of the song. And this was just Broadway singing. And just fucking awful. They literally had dancers rolling on the ground like stones.
Sounds great.
And I was like, oh, it only lasted on Broadway for 3 weeks. How did it get to Broadway? Who said this is going to be good? And I don't know what the story is or anything else. I literally watched like 5 minutes of it and then went and watched a few minutes more. But
who criticizes Dylan's voice? Like, I love his voice because you hear his voice and you know it's immediately him. Like, to me, that is a great voice.
Well, it was the butt of a lot of jokes, like a lot of stand-up comedians. Make fun of Bob Dylan.
Oh, Dana. But you're right. Dana Carvey always did him.
Yeah, you know, a ton of them did. But, you know, it's not a pretty voice. It's an effective voice. It's instantly recognizable, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, like, have you all ever seen that movie, I'm Not Here? Is that what it is?
Yeah, yeah. I love it. I think it's one of the best biopics ever made. Ever.
Yeah. Is that what it's called? I feel like that's wrong.
Maybe.
I'm not there.
I've never seen it, but I do have an idea for a musical in the back of my head that would be stealing that concept, except it would be about Alex Jones.
Just have a bunch of actors playing Alex Jones.
Like all the people that he hates the most, a different person playing him in a different scene.
Honestly, sounds great.
I just got to learn how to write.
Christian Bale, Kate Blanchett, Heath Ledger, Ben Whishaw, Richard Gere.
Yeah.
All right.
And many
Chris
others.
Christopherson.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. It's a great flick, really. Go watch it. It's Highlander.
Scott, you also had some not so great news come up this past week, didn't you?
I did. One of my mentors, old college professor Helen Manville, passed away last week. And she had recruited me at Penn State. She put me in my first show at Penn State. And she was just this sort of force of nature. She and her husband, who had retired before I got there, literally wrote the Theater 101 book. Book that was used at Penn State. So she was brilliant and awesome. And my favorite story was my senior year. I had a house. I rented a house with two other roommates, and it was the party house. And we would often host opening night parties and that kind of thing, and closing night parties, and any excuse to host a party. And so my roommate Dave Apichel and I were running around trying to collect money for the keg to get it. And Helen was like, what are you guys doing? And we're like, we're just trying to raise money for the keg for opening night party. And she was like, oh, it reaches in and like slaps down $100 bill. She's like, here you go. And paid for the keg. And like, but she was just that kind of person. Like, her office was always open. You know, if you walk by, you know, she would call your name, then you were summoned into the office to sit down and have coffee and just chat about stuff, theater and life and otherwise. And
she sounds rad.
She was really rad. She was the sort of mother of the theater department.
Here's a question I think I already know the answer to. Did she run a good rehearsal room?
She did. It was very clear. And that's a great segue, my friend. Well done.
Just saying. Yeah, welcome to Theater Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Burcham.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
It's true. And each week we get together to discuss and debate the definition. Sorry. Well,
yeah. You got it. You got
it. Yeah. The alliteration is hurting my tongue a little bit. I have a little bit of a sore throat, so I apologize. I'm going to let you all talk a lot this episode, which is not something I am want. But I do want to do it, so I'm going to. No, each week we get together to discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. This week's a Scott's pick. We're sorry, we are punting a little bit. We told you we'd be covering Roddy Viegas this week, but unfortunately, there has been 100 different things come up for all of us. Like, it's just been, it's, we've all been at fault at some point, except for Roddy. Roddy's great, and we love Roddy. But we are making sure that that happens. We're going to record it all in 2 weeks. So you're getting an episode this week, and you're getting an episode next week, and then you'll get Roddy again.
Yes.
We're sorry for that, but it's going to happen, we promise.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're just going to close out the season and do the whole thing, but we'll talk about that later. Scott, it's your choice today. Mm-hmm. What did you decide you wanted to talk about, and why?
I decided that we should do an episode on the process. The process of putting on a show, the process of directing, the process of acting, which I know is sort of a big old can of worms to open. But we have just finished working on a project together, the three of us. We've mentioned on previous episodes, we did a reading of Bailey and his wife Rachel's play, Mothers of God, that... CJ and I were both in, and I also produced, and we went through a process that then got extended because of, surprise, COVID, and then did two really, really wonderful nights of stage reading performances for audiences, and it was really great and successful. But as we were kind of scrambling to do this week's episode and come up with a topic, it just seemed sort of a natural segue, because every time once I'd started directing, I didn't do this in my early years, but once I started directing regularly, that's when I sort of started evaluating process and evaluating rehearsal experience, both as a director and as an actor, after the fact. And then certainly as a producer, you know, that where you're dealing with money and logistics and all that kind of stuff and schedules, reevaluating and figuring out, you know, the most efficient way to do things and the best way to collaborate with people to create an amazing final product. And so just wanted to talk about it and share some stories and experiences and cool things that have happened and cool things that I've learned along the way.
Hells yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
After doing notes on this today, I kind of realized this is going to be an episode where I think I'm going to be bragging about myself a lot. So get ready, everybody.
Right, right. Yeah, I think it'd be cool to just start talking about, I think we all started as performers before directing or writing or producing or anything else. What was, and we've obviously talked about our experiences, our educational stuff, but what was your experience and when did you both feel like you had your process locked in? Not that it's immovable, but did at what point, how old were you and at what point in your career did
as
you
an
feel
actor?
Like, yeah. Mm. Did you feel like, ah, I've got, this is how I'm doing it. This is how I'm going to do it from here on out. Siege?
Well, I think, honestly, like, because I wrote down a bunch of notes from, like, when I was a kid, what my process was as a kid, and then how it changed into conservatory, and now how I am as an adult. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that I discovered is it is a process that is going to be ever-changing. I pick and choose things that work for me. Sometimes they don't work for me in other times. And then I think my process as an actor also changed when I started doing other jobs, when I started stage managing and producing and directing and choreographing. And then everything changed again. And I don't mean drastically changed, but things shifted and changed because of COVID and AB5. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I definitely have a way I like to do things, and it's more like I have a way that I want to feel when I walk into rehearsal. Mm. And what do I have to do to feel that way walking into rehearsal? And I think that that's going to change probably even depending on what kind of project I'm doing, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bales?
Yeah. To me, it all solidified in college in terms of what I would consider my quote-unquote process. Unfortunately, I am someone who... my process is quite simple. Like, I don't need a whole lot of shit. I do my same warm-up I learned in college from mm-hmm. Scott Stackhouse, who is my mm-hmm. my stage combat and voice and speech coach. And he was just... He fucking ruled. And I still do. I teach that warm up to the kids at Shakespeare Youth Festival. I do it before anytime somebody asks me to lead a warm up. That's the one I run because it works so well. And it ends up being pretty ubiquitous, like universal at least. Like, people tend to be like, oh, that really worked for me. There were things I would cut or things I would add. But like, the structure really works for a lot of people. And it feels a bit academic, I'm sure, to some people. But I very much do it on my own. And in terms of the process of acting, I haven't done it in so long, for real, like not a real production where I really dug into a character. The last time I did that was Danny in the Deep Blue Sea, which was 7 years ago.
Mm.
So it's like, to me, that process was me just doing what I had done all through college. And that was just pretty simple. I don't do a whole lot. And I think we can dig into more of what our processes are, but, you know, down the road. But, like, I have found more process as a director in the last decade of my life than as an actor. But maybe I'm a little behind. I think it could shift and change if I did more. But I do feel basically like I'm doing the same shit I was doing in college.
Right.
Yeah. What about you, Scott?
Yeah, it's funny how I was just talking about this the other day. As an actor, and one of the things that I appreciated and one of the reasons I went to Penn State was they kind of exposed you to as much stuff as possible so you could throw out what wasn't working for you.
Same for conservatory.
You know, just like, yeah. And so what I learned about myself was that I'm a very instinctual actor. Like, I kind of like attack it, and I kind of like to get the big lump of clay in front of me, and then through the rehearsal process in my own time, like, mold that lump of clay. But I'm really kind of jumping into it and attacking it. As I've gotten older, I've just experience and knowledge makes that a little bit easier. But then as a director, though, I'm very much the opposite. Like, I'm very much like kind of spreadsheets, meticulous, multiple copies of scripts so I can write different notes on. I have my own color ink system when working on a script and that kind of stuff. So and then that's also informed my acting as well. I don't think anything has informed my acting more than directing. That's for sure.
Mm.
But both just in terms of being in a room and understanding. I think this happens with age too. I think it's one of the things that the Brits do so much better than us, which is we kind of focus immediately on what's your character's objective? What does your character want? What is all that stuff. And I think that what the Brits do is how does my character serve this story? And that's kind of where I'm at now more these days. What is this character doing to serve this overall story? And then everything else kind of falls into place a little bit easier. And I think makes your work more interesting to do that. Just with Mothers of God, where I had an opening monologue and then just a few little scenes throughout the rest of the play. But it was very evident what that character was serving, who that character was. I also had the benefit of knowing the playwrights, so getting feedback from them early on helped a lot. But yeah, for sure.
Do you find yourself, you talked about, like, you know, now as an actor, you sort of take in, or you use a different word, but you watch the process of other directors and things. Do you find that you judge it as well? Because I do. That's something that's kind of a reason I don't act so much anymore, is that I find myself judging the process of others, and that's been hard for me.
I see exactly what you're saying. No, and I think that that's because one of the things that I've learned and one of the benefits that I've gotten from doing Sacred Fools and theater in LA, where we were doing a lot of late night shows and a lot of like fast and furious preparation and that sort of thing, has led me to really walk into the room knowing what hat I'm wearing at that moment. So I'm trying to make sure I connect with the director, but I don't think I judge them as much as I used to. What about you, Siege?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that, Bailey, because I started as an actor and then I picked up the other things. I think the first thing I tried out outside of acting was stage management. And the thing that informed how I was as a stage manager was the amount of times I'd been in a room with a stage manager that was maybe disorganized or didn't like the actors or whatever, a myriad of different things, and thinking, I think I could maybe do a better job at this. And that's kind of what's informed when I've been a director or a choreographer or a producer. And then again, it informs back to my acting. Like I just kind of, I mean, I just actually, this isn't theater, but I just worked my first ever second AD thing on a non-union local commercial. And I was terrified to go in because I was like, I've never done this before. I haven't been on set a whole lot. They're gonna know that I'm a phony. But then I just remembered, like, when I was background on a film or whatever, what were the things I hated about it? And then I tried to use that to inform how I was dealing with the background people as a second AD. So, I mean, there's always stuff to learn, but I'm not saying that I sit there and judge everybody, but as an actor, I've sat there and I've been like, this isn't going so well. You know what I mean? And certainly that happens a lot when before all of this, everyone was in the room for free, you know?
And I don't even mean so much like I'm sitting there judging, like, oh my God, this
Yeah,
fucking
yeah, yeah,
bitch.
yeah,
Like,
yeah.
it's not
No, I
like
know
that.
what you
It's
mean.
more like it's when you're sitting there and you're like, oh, I would have answered that differently to be more clear. That would have made this go quicker and would
Yes.
have, and then that's where my brain's at, and it shouldn't be, right? And that has been tough for me, which is why I y'all do a really good job of wearing like multiple hats in a room. I don't. I just it's not something I'm great at. It's something that you know, I'd rather be focused in one place and just be there, because my brain will be in the other places. We all sort of promise, like, nope, I'll be the actor when I'm in the room, and I'll be the producer when I'm out of the room, and I'll be the whatever, you know. I can't. It's just not for me.
Well,
Like, it's
and
just not for me.
that's actually something I've noticed lately because I've found myself in a handful of projects that I'm acting in, but I'm also producing. And there's people that it doesn't matter if somebody asked me to produce while I was also performing, I would automatically say yes because I just there's people that I'd do anything for. But I've decided recently, like, I don't love producing while I'm acting because there's a million things that I am worried about in rehearsal or even going into a performance or even during a performance that I'm like it's I'm in my producer brain and it's not fun. It just makes for an anxious situation for me.
They're also just such different processes. If we're talking about processes, you know, like, and I think there's people that can balance. You guys seem to be able to, and but like I mean, you
It's
do, like,
going
and
crazy inside my
well, right.
head.
For me, it is too, and it makes it that I know for a fact I'm not doing the 100% of either. That I'm
Oh,
maybe
okay.
doing like 60 of each, right? Like, I mean,
Right,
obviously that math doesn't make sense, but you know what I mean? Like, I'm
right,
only giving that much to either at any given moment because I know that I have to save energy for the other, or
Sure.
like save brain space, like emotionally maybe for the
Right.
other.
Oh, yeah.
And that is fucking hard. And you know, kudos to everybody who's able to do that. I think people who wear multiple hats and are great at it are we need more of them. You know what I mean? But it's, I'm not one of you. and that's okay.
I actually wanted to ask the two of you, something that came up while I was putting notes down for this was, were you all ever required to take text analysis in theater school or like research or something? How was that for you? Because I have a very specific feeling about it.
Mine's super quick. I took it from a guy named Tim Noble. He's a man who has like a nice little career, but he also this is at Hogwarts. He also was cut out of the movie Tombstone and was pretty bitter about it. But we love this man. But we love this man, Tim Noble. And his whole thing, like, we would sit in a circle, sometimes outside, and just, like, talk. It was a lot of talking, and he would ask really specific questions to people, like, to you. Like, he'd look at you and, like, relate it to you somehow and bring it out, and it was a very good discussion class. I then took it again later during my BFA, and it was one of the worst classes I've ever taken in my life.
Oh no.
Wow.
Because it was all PowerPoint driven, and it was all there was very little discussion, and it was all very like
technical.
This is correct and this is not correct.
Sure.
And that it, to me, is not what script analysis, text analysis is about. And therefore it showed in these two different schools, it showed in the rehearsal processes of each, where the way we were doing text analysis at Hogwarts was so detailed and in-depth, and the way we were doing it at Wichita fucking State was just like pulling poop out our butts. It was poopy buttholes. It was terrible.
What about you, Scott?
Mine, we used backwards forwards. I don't know if
I have that.
Remember.
Yeah, I have it right here.
It's actually a great little book. The class was always very frustrating for me. Sometimes, and I think this happened early on, especially learning Shakespeare and Scansion, was sometimes it gets too technical to the point where my brain shuts down. I'm like, this isn't my thing. Like, I need to feel it. I need to feel it in my balls. I need to feel it
to process it.
In my loins.
In your glands.
In my glands.
Yeah.
But it was fine. Like, I don't, what was your experience? Why do you bring it up?
Well, we had to take a semester of text analysis my freshman year, and my freshman year in college was fraught anyway, just cause I was homesick and went through a breakup like 2 months in and was depressed and fucked up. And like, I was so unprepared. Like, I went to such a shitty public high school that I got no exposure whatsoever to scripts, to actual theater, to like decent teachers. So when I went into conservatory and all of a sudden we had all of this work dumped on us, I was overwhelmed. So text analysis was like, okay, well, and we got a syllabus, like we knew what was coming, but I was a dipshit kid and didn't know how to write papers. And like a lot of people procrastinated till the last moment.
What?
So like this Friday would come up and we would have to turn in an in-depth, we covered two plays. We did A Zoo Story and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Oof.
And I still have those scripts. They're highlighted with different colors of highlighter depending on what I was supposed to be looking up. And we would sit in an actual library and pull actual books out the night before and chug espressos and just try to pull together this paper about time and place for A Zoo Story. And it had to be, you know, 10-page long paper, which seemed impossible to me. So text analysis just seemed like a big fucking homework assignment to me. But I didn't connect. My 18-year-old brain did not connect why we were doing it, why I would need to know this stuff, that it would actually inform, you know. And granted, we were just taking plays and analyzing them. We weren't taking plays, analyzing them, and then doing scenes from it or performing them or anything.
Right.
So maybe that's where the disconnect was. So like text analysis, I remember standing in front of my teacher and just weeping at the end of class because he was like, I don't think you're getting this. And I was like, please, please don't put me on warning or probate. Like, because then the whole thing connected to that was, if I didn't get it, then I get put on warning. And then if I didn't improve, then I get put on probation. And then if I didn't improve, I get taken out of the program. So, but that was all lore, and like Cut's program was never what it was by the time I was there, but it was something that the students talked about all the time.
Right, right.
But by go ahead.
That's a great point. And the, I did have similar frustrations. I'm like, why isn't all this connected? If we're going to do, if we're reading Godot and doing an analysis of Godot, then why aren't we turning around and doing scene work from Godot? Like where, you know, but that also gets just into academia and why that can be tricky, especially with art and especially with a collaborative art like theater, is that, you know, you know, professors and politics, you end up, you know, sort of staking your ground, and this is what we're going to cover, and this is how I'm going to teach it.
Right. But our teacher, Gary Glasgow, who's actually still at Conservatory, who is a wonderful teacher, and I had him for a couple, he was one of my acting teachers too. He taught my Ibsen and Chekhov acting class. Lovely guy, really talented actor. I'm sure he explained to us why it was important. But this is me again. I know I bring this up all the time when we're reading stuff where I'm like, oh, well, I read that in college. Yeah, I did. But I didn't retain anything because my brain was so fucking underdeveloped. Like, it's another thing to me why it's like there is no problem with people taking time off after high school before you jump into college.
Yeah, I definitely wish I had done that. But I also think, you know, it's how it's taught to you at a certain age, too, that makes you retain it or not retain it. It's not always, like, our fault. Absolutely. When we, you know, I will say that. Like, I think, because, like I said, Tim Noble, the guy who made it interesting, like, we did, that year, we did August Osage County, Cloud Nine, Sunday in the Park, like, which I didn't know before that class. He introduced it to me. So, like, these huge, Ruined was on there. These monumental plays that, like, that still live with me, not just because of this podcast, right? Like, and when we talked about them, I was able to say, like, I know this play.
Right.
Like, you know, and I think, but then I don't even remember what we read in my you know, in my second degree. I think it must have, it was, I know we did like Master Harold and the Boys, but I barely remember it.
Sure.
You know, things like that. And it just wasn't as engaging. And I think when we're in the process of a show, it's easy to be engaged because you're playing the role. So you're already excited about it. When you're in a classroom, and I think you're right, Scott, like it would be, if it wasn't that there's also probably tech people taking the show or taking the classes and non-actors, directors and writers taking the class as well. I think performing it, you know, or doing something with the text beyond just writing papers, it would behoove.
Theater. And then it all clicked in my junior year. By the time you get to junior year at Conservatory, you start getting to do dialects and accents. And we actually had a sabbatical teacher in Christopher Gurr, who is working in New York. Like, he was in the Spamalot tour. Like, he's a great actor. And he was a Webster grad, and he came back to teach for a teacher that actually left for a year. And when you learn standard British and we're in restoration class, we were required to memorize all of the lyrics to the song Modern Major General from Pirates of Penzance. And then we were supposed to put on our full restoration costumes, stand in restoration stance, and then as a class recite all of the lyrics with a standard British dialect. Now, we learned it all. We're standing in class. We have our fans. We're having a great fucking time. And then he's like, and he counted us down and he was like, and go. We get to the end of the first line and he goes, stop. He's like, okay, what did that first line mean? And, you know, that's to anyone that knows that song, it's full of insane vocabulary words. And all of us kind of stopped and nobody knew. We just learned the words. And he said, you should know what every single word of this means. You are actors. Words are your paints. Words are your clay. You need to know what you're talking about. And that was the first time that I was like, oh, my God, that's right. So, like, now part of my process is going through the script, and if I don't understand something, even if it's just what a fucking word means, I look it up so I know what the hell I'm talking about.
Sure, sure.
Simple shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do y'all do a lot of script stuff?
No.
Like physically writing in scripts?
I put No. I put my blocking in the script, and I get off book as fast as fucking possible.
Word.
I hate looking at my script. I hate, you know, like, I just, I'm... And now I'm very visual, so I do keep my script on me, and actually one of my more embarrassing moments is walking off stage, Danny in the Deep Blue Sea, scene one, and everybody seeing my dramatist script in my back pocket because I was a whole fucking idiot.
Nice.
Yeah, but
meta, bro. Yeah, I see it. Meta, bold choice. Bold choice, man.
I don't.
I'm the same. I like to get off book as soon as possible, but I like to highlight my script. I highlight my lines and I highlight my name in any stage directions. I'll scribble in any word meanings that I need to. I always put my blocking in because, my God, I still work with fucking full-grown ass adult doctors, actors that don't write their blocking in there, and then they don't know what the fuck they're doing, and it's really annoying.
I'm going to wing it. I'm going to see where I feel like I should go.
You know, in college, I did do the action verbs and shit. You know, like, I did all that.
I had the dictionary. I still have that book. Recently, too. Oh, it was such a good one, though.
I think I might have two copies.
Motions, you mean?
No.
No,
like,
it was a verb dictionary and thesaurus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was cool.
You could find just your action, and I remember that was a big thing for me. Not to digress too much, Bailey. I'm so sorry.
No, this was
when I was given the power of verbs. It was Michael Conley. Which was my first year at Penn State, which was my technically third year of college, but sophomore year. And he was like, "What's the verb? What are you doing?"
Yeah.
And I was like, standing. He's like, "That's not very, like, that's not a very good one." And then that led to, which I don't always use, like, I'll instinctively come up with them. But when I'm trapped sometimes and not sure where to go, really digging in and finding that verb in a moment, in a scene, will help me a great deal.
That sounds like Laban motions to me.
It just sounds
like the same thing. Other than highlighting, because I learned the beats and the objectives and all of that stuff that everyone always learns in theater school. But I write in meanings of stuff that I don't know. And then actually, and maybe this is more with readings, if there's a line that is just not working for me, I'll go through it and then I'll figure out, that's the word that I need to be pointing towards, and I'll circle it. And then any other notes that are in there other than blocking are when the director gives me a really good acting note that's helping me out in a moment, and then I'll scribble that in there. But that's pretty much it.
Bailey, we digress. What were you saying?
I think, I don't know. I don't remember. I think it was just that. I was just talking about
the verb dictionary.
Yeah. Just like, well, you had asked what, you know, do you do script shit? And cause the action verb stuff is interesting. And I guess what CJ is referring to is the Laban shape stuff. Is that what you're talking about?
No, it was what I learned with the Laban motions was like, I want to poke with this line, right. That type of thing.
That's what it is.
Sure. Yeah, but there's, yeah. Anyway, so I think to me, it's like, it's all about like there was the whole thing about like, you know, do you want to fuck this person, kill this person, or,
oh, okay.
You know, love this person or whatever, right. You know, like bold, going with the bold choice. And I think that was stuff I used to write in. Mm-hmm. I don't really anymore. I mean, again, like, it's been so long. Maybe if I got like a really heavy, meaty role, I would be like, all right, let's get in here. Yeah. I do a bit of scansion if I'm doing Shakespeare.
If it's
in verse. I have to sometimes.
Yeah, I do too.
And it excites me when I find things like feminine endings and like weird shit where I'm like, ooh. Okay. You know, like, I'll do something weird with that. Like, that stuff's fun. And especially because I teach it to the kids, I just like, I might as well do it.
Sure.
You know, I should do it.
When you figure out if it's reverse stressed.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you know, right. When it's like, oh, what is it?
A trochee, I think. A trochee,
that's it. Yes, yes. When you find a trochee and you're like,
it's exciting. It gets exciting.
I just wanted to pitch in there. I loved, because we learned IPA at my school. And then when we got into Shakespeare, we did Scansion and everything. And I loved that stuff because to me, I kind of have a mathematical brain. To me, it was a math way to sound a way that I don't sound. Like with sound changes and stuff with dialects, I loved it because when I went to college, all of the juniors were like, you have a Midwestern dialect and here's why. So I loved that, but I also loved the math of Shakespeare of like, if I say this line straight, it means one thing. But if I start with the stress at the top, it means the character's thinking about something. And I kind of, it's almost like a secret code. Because, I mean, I'm sure your teachers told you this, but our Shakespeare teacher was like, everything is there. Shakespeare gives you everything you need to know about this character right there in the math of the verse. And I always,
teacher says, yeah.
I always fucking love that. I loved that. And I personally, like, I don't do it with a whole play, but if I have a speech that I'm doing, I will scan it just because I like doing it.
Yeah.
And then I've got my, what are the Shakespeare, the lexicons. I'll lexicon through the whole thing too if it's a speech.
Yeah.
I love No Fear.
What?
Fuck with No Fear?
I don't have No Fear. I have Speak the Speech and then I have the lexicons, but
I was just kidding.
I have looked at No Fear online before. It's a good resource if you're feeling stuck about something, for sure.
Yeah, I haven't really messed with it too much. But I'm in and out of Shakespeare so often. Like, I'm really looking forward to our end of this season and just sitting down and going over some Shakes the guy again. I did want to go back to, you know, you talk about breaking down beats.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found as an actor, I do it as a director. I break down beats as a director.
Yes, same here.
I generally don't fuck with it. Unless as an actor, I'm trying to find the arc of a specific scene or monologue where I can't find the high and low instinctively. I can't feel it out. But I also find that it is a way to, and this is kind of my next question, how to connect with people who have entirely different processes, entirely different educations, entirely different experiences from you. And so, like, when I've been frustrated with a scene partner in a play and gone, hey, can we sit down and break down these beats, that A, it's a way to connect a little bit, B, it's a little bit to get on the same page and really talk out what is and isn't working, especially when you have a shitty director. And that was one thing that, again, going back to, shout out to Michael Cottonley, who was like, I want to make you director proof by the time you walk out of here. I want to make you be able to walk into a regional theater, get the part, and not have to have a director and be that smart to do that. Obviously, there's, you know, layers to that. But I've had shitty directors who, not shitty directors, that's the wrong word. I've had directors who do not communicate well with actors.
Mm-hmm.
Theirs is about staging, theirs is about movement, theirs is about the play itself. And so to find that time and make sure that you're connecting with another actor on a technical level will, I think, help alleviate the difference between, you know, those who, you know, are more method or more whatever, you know, whatever school of thing you came from, just connect a little bit.
Page.
Yeah. Pass. Let me think. No, because I have a thought and I can't form it yet. So do you have anything you want to say before?
Yeah. Two things came to mind. One, and maybe this is a little too personal, but like having a relationship, some kind of friendly relationship, being able to have a conversation with the person that you're doing the scene with, that you're working with, and just being able to relate to them on a human level outside of rehearsal or during rehearsal, I feel usually helps, mm-hmm. like, ease you into a scene. Like, if you're comfortable with one another and you know one another to a certain degree, it makes it easier
right.
to just connect in a scene. And I don't know, maybe this is selfish, but, like, something clicked for me almost 10 years ago now in a show, of of the idea of, and it took me a long time to get to this, the idea of me being an authentic person. And if I'm authentic and real, how can I expect to be an authentic character and an honest character if I'm not honest in my real life? And then, I don't know, something clicked with me years and years ago about, like, instead of crafting a line to say it like I think this character would say it, it's like, well, why don't I just say it the way I would say it? Yeah. And I'm already playing this character. So, like, I don't know. I just, being honest, I feel like that's just, it's a really generic thing to say, but it's something that makes sense to me that has worked for me, I guess.
Sure.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. I think I have it, but it's
okay.
This, just, I'm just speaking personally because I said before, like, I have sort of a lack of process, especially as an actor, right? I think that does lend itself to me being able to absorb whatever the process of others tends to be, for better or worse. You know, there are times where that really can kick my ass, but there are times where I feel like I'm like, whatever my scene partner is doing, I'll vibe with that. I'll go with that process. I'd rather, you know, them feel comfortable than me have, or, you know, like I can bend easier than most, if that makes sense.
Sure.
But as a director, it's, to me, a different conversation because it's about expectation setting.
Mm-hmm.
And expectation setting early,
right?
And that means being a good communicator,
mm-hmm.
and that means culture setting every day and not just saying and then not doing, right? Like,
yes.
So, because I think that's a big piece of it too, is a lot of directors come in like, this is how it's gonna run, and then it doesn't run that way, and you're like,
sure.
Oh shit, I had expectations.
Well, then
that
you find out it doesn't work that way for everybody in the room,
right? Mm-hmm. Right. And a director's job in general, which, you know, I know y'all are more actor-centric currently, but you do both direct, and you and CJ, you choreograph. So you're in these positions more often than most actors would be.
Sure.
Right? And so I think you can understand this sort of, like, I want to pivot a little bit to directors, just a tiny bit, because...
No, I want to talk about my other jobs, too.
Yeah, because as directors, I think, you know, obviously you're the tone setter. Obviously, you're creating a vision in some senses, depending on where you are in the process, but usually that is the consensus that that's what's going on. But I think directors, that's kind of where their job stops. And a lot of people don't see it that way. A lot of people see director as hierarchy, as king, if you will.
A personality walking into the room, yeah.
Right. And or as auteur in many ways. Mm-hmm. And we're ruined by that because we're in Los Angeles. But because I don't think that's such a thing. Maybe Tame, you know, Julie Taymor, but like... Can you name a lot of theater directors in New York that you're like, I know that style. Every time it's him, I know it's that person.
Sure,
right?
Sure,
there's just not.
No.
Film, we got that all day. We got that up the wazoo, right?
Sure.
We just saw a Martin Scorsese film that felt like a Martin Scorsese film. Also, maybe
I'm
his
so
best
glad
movie
we went.
Year.
It was
we'll
great.
We'll talk about it later. But yeah, yeah. but I think director as collaborator is the piece that's missing from a lot of rooms.
Agreed.
Yeah.
And I really, I just wanted to bring up this book that I read in college that I keep and I still read all the time just to like remind myself of shit. It's called Director as Collaborator by Robert Knopf, K-N-O-P-F.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. The first page of the introduction has a lot of great quotes already on it, but my big highlighted quote that's circled over and over again says, collaboration does not preclude leadership. Rather, it is a style of leadership.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And I think we are all kind of, sorry, tiny, tiny monologue, just because I'm obsessed
with
this
shit. No,
bring
it.
But
yeah,
the beginning of directing, if we're talking about pageant wagon theater, tragedians, back in the day, okay? Like old school, legit.
Back in the day.
Back in the day. Which someday we should just do like a pageant wagon.
That'd be great.
You know,
I'd love
episode
to.
Episode of some sort. But... there was no director, and maybe even in Shakespeare times, there was no director piece of the puzzle. There were writers, tragedians, quote-unquote producers, and then there were pageant masters, and the pageant masters were sort of the I'm going to make sure it all happens person, but they weren't considered like the artiste of the piece, right?
Sure.
And a lot of the times the writers would just quote-unquote direct the piece that they were doing, but it wasn't like considered a pinnacle, a pedestaled position.
Mm-hmm. I wonder when that changed. Do you know?
Honestly, Broadway.
Oh.
it was the, you know, the 40s and 50s, and like people started becoming more like driven towards the names behind who was making things, and then you have film, and you have Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd and Charlie Chaplin, sure. And the theater wanted to follow suit, and they're sort of like, okay, well, let's, you know, what is it? Logan was one of the last name was one of the big R&H directors,
yeah, yeah.
And Jonathan Logan or Joshua Logan or something like that. You know, and so it became this really pedestaled, that's, I don't know how to say that differently, like position, and it has kept that, and now it to me can really ruin a process, mm-hmm. and can be like a really big issue, and I as director always want to see myself and bring present myself and bring myself into the room as I am on the same plane as every single other person in this room. Mm-hmm. Or what else are we doing here?
Mm-hmm.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? Like, it takes every piece of this puzzle, every position to make theater happen. So to pretend like the director is some, like, visionary who needs control of every space, who needs to be the only voice heard, who needs to, all this shit, like, to me is the death of good theater.
Yes.
Mm. Now my throat hurts enough that I'm going to stop. Thank you. Okay.
It's interesting because I've been having conversations with a friend of the pod, Tyler Stillwell, who I went to college
love
with.
Tyler.
He's a
teacher and a director and an actor, and it's marvelous. And his new thing that he's talking to me about that he's been putting into his classes is he negates nothing. Mm. He never says no. He mm-hmm. never says that's a bad choice or I disagree with your choice. Mm. He keeps pushing them and then and prodding them with yes. If your instinct is telling you to go there, yes, yes. And then trying to keep that energy going in order to then maybe shift the focus or shift the energy or an element of the scene without negating any of the actor's choices. And seeing where that comes up. So what he's doing, I just realized this recently, is he is creating a process, an acting process that demands positive energy and collaboration by definition. In order to pull that off, you can't be an island. And, you know, I think too often actors are just naturally inclined to want to be islands and
sure.
want to be the focus of attention. And so the really great ones, you know, give that up. We talk about the Brits a lot, but I think that one of the things that the Brits do is they do lots of Shakespeare from the beginning. And the nature of any Shakespeare play is you're going to have time off. You're going to be off stage. You're not
right.
going to be the central thing because there's usually, you know, three to four storylines happening.
Right.
There's
right.
a few exceptions to that. You know, obviously Hamlet and Lear, Richard III, you know, are exceptions to that. But you think about like any of the other title ones, Othello, he's only in that play for 55%
Iago
of the play.
Iago is the biggest voice we hear in that.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And even Iago has their time off as well. So you have this sort of balance and it naturally teaches you that you are a part of an ensemble, whether that's 20 people or two. And that's an important lesson, I think, you know, I think we all struggle with because we all, you know, crave that energy and attention. But sometimes, you know, sometimes just doing a little bit, dropping the mic and walking off for the rest of the show is great, you know. I've done shows where I don't leave fucking stage, and I've done
sure.
shows where I'm only on stage two or three times, and both are just as satisfying when you know what you're doing and, again, serving the story. You're telling the story.
Yeah, I think I'd almost rather be a memorable one-scene performance.
Right.
At the end of a show where people walk out like, but that one scene, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny.
For me, any level of production staff that I've been on when I haven't been acting, to me, the key for that helps me feel good going in there as an individual, and I guess it's the same thing with my acting, is I come in prepared. The amount of times I've been in a production meet, like a pre-show meeting with a producer that has no fucking idea what they're doing next, makes me crazy. I know I've bitched about this on the podcast before, but walking into a dance rehearsal and then the choreographer turns on some music and it's like, let's move around and create this dance together. I'm like, you didn't do a single bit of work.
You didn't do
this.
Your work.
Did you? Yeah. And I mean, even with, and this is just because I, for the longest time, didn't see myself as a director. So when I was asked to direct something, I went back to directing 101 and I pre-blocked the entire show. But because of that, I walked into rehearsal and I'm the same directing that I am with choreography. I walk in and I say, listen, I have every beat of this ready to go. There are no bad questions. Things are going to change. That's great. I will change my notes and we will work through it together. And with my directing, it was a fringe show. So it was a little lower stakes than like a big, it was just like a 50-minute one act. But I went in and I said, guys, I have pre-blocking. I'm going to give you all your blocking through this. You're going to write it down. We're going to run it once and we'll make any changes we need to make so that everyone feels comfortable. But it cut our rehearsal time in half. Yeah. Like and I'm the same. Like, I agree with you too, Bailey, of like, I am a collaborator. I've had dancers come up or I've had actors come up and say, this isn't working for me. And then we work through it and we figure something out. But I kind of like to go in and let everyone know, like, hey guys, I know where we're going with this. Things are going to change, and that's going to be fine because we're going to make this together.
Organic theater making has its place, obviously, right? There are many theater companies who do that. They just devise, and they just organically build things. And I'm like, great, do that. But I agree with you, Siege. I'm the ultimate, like... And Los Angeles, I think, is the hub of this, because I did not experience this so much in Kansas City doing theater, but there's this sort of like nonchalance and laziness surrounding theater because we all love it. So it'll be great. We'll just build it in the room.
Right.
And I'm like, if you really love it, like I do, you're thinking about it so much that you can't help but pre-block.
Yeah.
You can't help but come in being like, I see this perfectly. Now let's build it together. Like, that's what it is. And so then when people, you ask them to build and bring in choices, you ask them, you know, and a lot of people in LA can't do that. A lot of people in LA don't really have the ability to collaborate as actors. They just want you to tell them exactly what to do.
Sure.
And sometimes you can do that for people. But I think that has led more and more directors to think, well, I just have to tell everybody exactly what to do and give them my vision.
And I'm not interested in that.
Not interested in that. I'm just not. And I think that's one of the reasons we bonded, the three of us early on, was us being like, you know, we can collaborate from any position and still feel artistically fulfilled and not feel like we're just a robot spouting lines, or we're just, you know, we get to use the words as paint. Yes. But also as producer, like being welcome to the producer, giving thoughts and being in the room and being a piece of the puzzle artistically and not just the person putting up the money or signing the checks or making sure there's stands in the room. Right. And I think that's what we're missing from Los Angeles theater specific. I don't want to speak to other theater communities because this is the one we know. This is the one we represent. Yeah. And in all honesty, the theater communities I was in before this were not this way. Mm-hmm. So it is very interesting. Now, I was a kid. You know, I was in educational theater mostly.
Right.
And then like music theater, Wichita, right? But like in those places, I was spoiled. Everything was always... what felt like everyone was trying to do the the pinnacle of work, the mm-hmm. zenith of what we could do. Mm-hmm. And out here, it does feel a bit like, let's just do it for fun and let's just...
For practice, for film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah.
And that, you know, and I think things are changing because of AB5 and a variety of things and babies mm-hmm. and babies.
Grogu.
Grogu.
But also the added layer in terms of collaboration with an institution, with a theater, with the artistic director of a theater, with the producer, with the literary director. I remember doing the Pasadena Playhouse in particular, and like everybody being there for that first read, and how electrifying that became, because you need an audience. I think every first reading kind of needs an audience. You know, you need somebody, I think, having a group of people who are invested, who are part of it, who are, you're telling the story to that first time mm-hmm. that you're all sitting around telling the story to each other, you know, is cool. And, you know, I'm thinking about like just some of the cool things that I've done or have had done to me over the years. And yeah, man, it's hot. It's hot to get into a room and fucking create something cool with people when you're serving the play. And I think that that's also the key, is you got to serve the play. That's your visionary, you know. In film, it's the director. It is the auteur, but the director is the one who's ultimately doing it. In theater, it is the actor and the playwright's medium, and the playwright has given you the thing, and the play is the thing.
Well, and something that's piggybacking off of that, something that I have, as I've gotten older, that has shifted and changed with me. When I first got out here, it was about being with a company or a specific director or a specific group of people. But now I'm at a point in my life where I prefer to just choose the group that I work with that possibly have the same kind of work ethic or process that I do. And it makes it all, that makes it even more fun when you're not sitting there pissed off that so-and-so doesn't do that, like is behind or shows up late all the time or whatever. Like that's been a new part of my process of like, I want to just pick my team from now on.
Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, but I always like meeting new people. We got to meet a ton of cool people on Mothers of God. Like that was a real joy. Like, it's so rare that you're in a dressing room, especially with a cast of 11, and there's not a real asshole in there. There wasn't a jerk in there. You know, everybody was so cool and lovely and just wanted to work on it and also just embrace the show. Like that was the other cool thing about that, was everybody was like, yeah, let's do this play. Mm-hmm. Fuck yeah. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should do a sequel episode to this that's about theater culture general, because I think that's a different thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to talk more about like rehearsal culture and about like, you know, how do you run a room? And I think that's part of process.
Yeah.
But also like the art of gathering in general, I think is really interesting. And I shouted out one book. I'll shout out another. The Art of Gathering. The full title is The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters, by Priya Parker. And it's not theater specific, but it inherently is, because mm-hmm. what else are we doing in theater but gathering,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's all about, like, in its simplest form, it's all about how to make everyone feel comfortable and, like, they are welcome there while also being interesting and provocative and, like, perking people up in a way that keeps them there, and then also like ending things in a way that makes everybody feel like the night has come to a close,
and also just like, getting the work done.
Yeah, right. And it's all about that, really. It's all about preparation.
I definitely have thoughts about all that.
Yeah, and I want to get into that. I don't think this is the episode for
that.
Agreed. So we'll make that happen soon.
Yeah.
Do you guys have anything else you want to talk about process-wise?
I have a quick and dirty question for the both of you.
Oh. Yeah.
What is your process at half hour?
Oh, okay.
Well, my process is at,
well, as an actor.
I was just talking about this. I'm not a half hour person. There's no way I would ever be there half hour early. If I can get into the space an hour and a half early, I'm there. I want to be there before everybody else. I want it to be quiet before the noise starts. And then I need it to get quiet I get very quiet half an hour before. But an hour and a half before, I'm in. I'm doing my warm-ups. I'm doing my stretches. I'm doing my vocals. I'm doing all that. I'm getting hyped up. And then I don't like chatting a lot, especially as we get closer to curtain. I like to be quiet and get into it.
I do my warm-up, and then I pace. I walk backstage. I walk around outside. I walk around wherever I can. I don't like sitting still.
Yeah.
If people talk to me, I'm usually okay with it, but I don't search for it. But yeah, I do my warm up and I go through my script, and that's, you know, and I move. I constantly move.
Yeah.
Again, like I don't have any like traditions or like have to's or anything like that. But
sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
My vocal warm up is I do the resonator warm up that I learned in voice and speech many moons ago. It's a perfect vocal warm up for me. I usually like to be on stage right before the house opens. Just like, sometimes I'll stretch. Sometimes I'll just sit in the middle of the stage and check shit out and take some deep breaths and stuff like that. And then I am an hour early person. I hate, if I get there at half hour, I'm a nervous wreck going on. So I try to do an hour early, try to have my face on by then. And then depending on the show. Now, when we did Deadly back in 2019, it was me and a bunch of other women that we all bonded and became really good friends. And the fucking dressing room was a madhouse before we started the show, because we were all just cracking jokes and yelling and cackling, which I'm sure drove all the guys crazy that were in the show. But then I have other shows that I have to get quiet for. And this happened with Mothers of God, actually. There was one night where people were just talking and cracking jokes and having a good time in the dressing room. And that's just not what I wanted at that moment. And I went backstage and I just sat there and waited for the show to start. So sometimes, depending on what show it is, I'll want to be loud and raucous. And then sometimes, and I'm also one of those people that it's like, if I want to be quiet and other people don't, I'm not going to impose that on them. I will remove my, there is some place that I can go to be by myself and be quiet if I need to.
Yeah, it's a theater.
As a director, my half hour, and as a writer also, is I go hide and I don't let anybody talk to me or ask me any questions.
You look at,
I'm like, it's a half hour before this show. If you can't figure it out without me, you can't figure it out. Sorry.
Yes.
That's my process.
I'll give a quick shout out to French Stewart, whose pre-show ritual, usually at half hour, was to go through the house and touch every seat in the house.
Oh, yeah.
So when we did Stoneface at Sacred Fools, that took 5 minutes
say,
or less.
650.
At Pasadena, he would be like, I made a bad mistake, like it. It seemed like halfway through. He's like, I'll be there soon. But I always thought that was a cool thing.
I've seen other actors do that. It is cool.
You know, I like a good
ritual.
I like to definitely be on stage for a bit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is there anything else you guys want to say? This is a great episode.
I could talk about this for hours.
We could, too. I think we should do a sequel on it.
Yeah,
we'll
do definitely
a
sequel.
Based
would be great.
Cool. Do you guys have any LA spitlets?
I do.
LA Spotlight.
Donkey, a cultural biography of a public school teacher, is one woman's clown Buffon journey into the absurd world of being a 21st century teacher as she navigates huggy adolescents, angry parents, and power tripping administrators.
Sounds great.
Written and performed by friend of the pod, Dr. Daisha.
Dr. Daisha.
It's part of the Spaghetti Festival at the Elysian Theater, which I didn't know was doing a bunch of live theater. It's a very cool space that I'd never been to. I watched a run through of it this last Saturday. It's fucking great. She's fucking great. It is on Wednesday, November 8th at 8 o'clock, and it's ElysianTheaterER.com/spaghetti for the Spaghetti Festival. Mm.
Okay.
Scott, you got anything?
No, I don't have anything right now. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I don't either.
Should be.
But go, you know, go see theater. Support theater in your local place where you live. The local place where you live. The local place where you live.
Yeah.
The local place where you live.
Thank you for joining us for part one of a 30-part miniseries we will be doing, just talking about bullshit. This was Scott's pick, Process. Next week, we will be covering Swimming. Oh, my. You okay?
Aww.
She's looking at me through the bars like she's in jail, and it's really
funny.
But next week we will be covering Swimming to Cambodia, the Jonathan Demme directed film. This will be part of our Jonathan Demme miniseries, since we already covered Stop Making Sense long ago. Now, this is a monologuist named Spalding Gray who discusses his time working on the movie The Killing Fields. So if you have the time and the stomach for it, I highly recommend watching The Killing Fields and then watching Spalding Gray's Swimming to Cambodia. It is definitely theater, but we will also debate that, because I don't know. I love y'all.
Yeah.
Good times. And I'll see you later.
Yeah. Do y'all have questions or comments? Reach out to us via Facebook, Instagram, email, or Twitter. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson. Ryan Thomas Johnson writes our theme song, and our theme song is better than your motherfucking theme song. I'll tell you that much.
Drunk.
He also writes all of our stingers, and he's a great person. And finally, to the great award-winning playwright Carol Churchill, who writes every single one of our episodes and doesn't even know it. And one day, Carol Churchill, we're going to buy you a beer.
Are we? Yeah. Good times. Subscribe, rate, review. It really does help. And we'll see y'all later. All right, this is a warm up that I do before every show.
Love
I
it.
Do mm-hmm. I do this before every show. You ready?
Do
Keep blogging while I'm mind boggling. Eyes on like I'm in the twilight, dog. And if my bone, this is my mic, dog. And I like hogging it. Flow so wet, I'm gonna take this beat tobogganing. I'm waterlogging it, I'm sogging it. Pull your verse out the beat and stomping it. Suplexing it on cement, like I'm on some straight out of Compton shit. Take this dick and chomping it. I'm so bad, I could bitch slap it back in a compliment. Jackassy to donkey dick. Game, I just about conquered it. Like Donkey Kong, I'm bonkers, bitch. I'm a king of this honky shit. I reign supreme of this honky shit. No sense screaming or nagu win. Makes no difference whether a Benz or a Bentley or a Beamer's the car you win. You think you ball while I palm it. I throw up bombs when I vomit. Boy, I throw down in the kitchen. Might hit your mom with my omelet, but you got egg on your face. Watch me drop an atomic. I should be strapped to the chest of a kamikaze. Bitch, I'm as batshit as Ozzy. It's obvious. You can tell right off the bat. No pun intended, but come any closer, I'll bite off your head. Trying to give me the fingers, kind of like giving a spider a web. I'm just going to spin it and try to use it to my advantage. You catch a fly in that bitch. You think you fly, you just food. I give as much of a flying fuck as that Superman dude. Guess I just do what you can do and make you look stupid and bamboozle. Confused as usual, and you can get rich. You can open a can too. So I hope you can handle the heat or stay the fuck out of Hell's Kitchen. I came to cock block like a square fucking male chicken. Yeah, it's Bailey Sluts. The rest can suck on a big one, because I'm as despicable as Daffy Duck when I'm spitting.
Ah, Shakespeare. Later.
It's Marlowe. It's Marlowe. Yeah.
The theater. The theater. Hang out, Louie. Theater. Theater. To be or not to be. Theater. Theater.